It originally was proposed as a forum topic by a couple of volunteer staff, who actually I don't see here tonight, on this whole question of multicultural music and borrowing from other cultures, whether this is like mining another culture or stealing or appropriating, or whether this is sort of a wonderful medley that happens when we take music from many different traditions and weave it all together. So I've asked Lowell Liebarger and Bruce Tammen to start us off with an opinion of theirs or whatever, some presentation, and then we want to open it up to all of you, and I can pose some questions if the conversation lags. We really do want to hear from all of you. It's not just like, you know, Nightline where Ted Koppel and all his studio guests talk to each other, a panel of experts, but rather at Holden, we consider either all of us are experts or none of us are experts, however you want to frame it, but everyone can have an opinion on these questions. So who should begin? Bruce, you presented on Monday, so you can go first, and Lowell, you can talk second here.
Well, an image that always stays in my mind in this regard was the, I guess it was the installation of the bishop or something of the newly formed ELCA in Chicago. The people who put together this event wanted very badly to have represented there the many branches of the new church. And friends of mine who participated in it said it was really bewildering, because the Lutheran Church I was brought up in was the Augustana Lutheran Church in Minnesota. There were two churches in our town. There was a Catholic church and there was the Augustana Lutheran Church. And you could tell just by walking on the sidewalk who belonged to which church. And that was Lutheranism to me. When I first moved to Chicago as a graduate student, that was the first, and I was 22 years old, that was the first I began to realize that there were other people that were beginning to creep into our church. And then it's just exploded since then into the current tremendous mixture of peoples with infinite ethnic backgrounds that make up our church. I say that as introduction because to me, it seems obvious that something has to happen to our musical traditions in the church. We can't just rely on the music that I, for instance, grew up with. I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater in this respect. There's, as I said in my session on Monday, the Lutherans have one of the most magnificent musical traditions of any of the basic denominations of Christianity. We have wonderful music, wonderful composers in our background, and I would hate to see that stuff thrown out. And my biggest complaint with the Green Hymnal is that there's only two Bach chorales in it, and they're not even Bach's harmonizations, which really makes them not Bach's chorales, since he didn't write the melodies, he just wrote the harmonizations. And I go back myself to the Red Hymnal just because they have about 12 or 13 in there, and I think that's glorious music, and I don't think it should be thrown out. And I don't have an answer at all, that's why it's a forum and not a presentation, as to what should be done for the future. I suppose these things just work themselves out over time. You have a thesis, antithesis, and finally something happens. But I would say, relative to my own experiencing of new music that's being tried out in the church, relative to my own experience as a church musician, that whatever we do, it's got to be good. It's got to be well done. It's got to be done with comprehension and appreciation by the ministers of music, by the pastors, by the parishioners that are participating in it. It can't just be a mishmash. It can't be just easy, feel-good music based on, you know, just the easy, feel-good aspects of our popular culture. When I hear church music that sounds an awful lot like you know, simple love songs, and it begins to sound to me like, oh God, come down and bless my relationship with this girl, you know. When the music sounds sentimental and shallow like that, I don't think that is the right approach. I don't think that the music of the future for the Lutheran Church should be shallow in order to satisfy more people. Whatever we adapt from other cultures, other ethnic backgrounds, I think it should be really good stuff. I feel very strongly like the Renaissance musicians who felt that they had to give the very best that they could do, the very best of their talents, as worship in praise of God. I have a personal conviction in this regard. I remember when I first came to Holden Village, and before I had finally decided I was going to be a professional musician, and I was obsessed with the parable of the talents. It meant a great deal to me, and I read it over and over again and asked all these people in the village about it. Does this mean I'm trapped into being a musician? What does this mean? I guess I really feel that we have to give the best we've got to the church rather than sit in worship and say, oh, I'm such a weak person with such meager talents, but it's good enough for God. You know, I don't personally like that at all. I want our music to be good, whatever it is.
Well, if you're looking for some kind of contrasting opinion to his, you're not going to find one, because he's basically said much of what I would like to say. But
okay, I'll represent mediocrity.
I so many points I agree with him, and I'll start off with my own with a couple stories. I've actually sort of been involved, well, I have been involved in doing multicultural experiments, if you will, in church liturgy. I go to a certain church in Seattle, and I joined the church about a year and a half ago, and I joined the choir. They immediately threw me in there, and they were really hard up for tenors, and so I immediately became their lead tenor, even though I never even sung in a choir before. I could hear notes and read them and such, but that says about something about the choir that I'm singing in. But, and I really had no problem at all singing traditional hymns in other pieces and wearing choir robe like many other more radical folks in my congregation who sing well don't like that as much. I have a great respect for tradition, being that I'm studying right now Indian classical music, and there's a great tradition involved in that as well, and learning from passing, it's an intergenerational aspect as well, and I won't get too much into that, but what I think is important is that we respect the traditions and the ideas of having some kind of fusion music of this or that. Most often results in a mediocrity of sorts. And what I see is a multiple tradition as the wave of the future, as opposed to trying to blend all this stuff together and, wow, look what we have, a cultural stew of sorts. What I think is important is to have, as Bruce was saying, integrity in representing these traditions. How you go about doing that, perhaps, is actually having people from these traditions perform or be involved in teaching this music and having it in the church. I think a great concern is to what extent are we losing our Christianity, the Christ-centered aspects of our faith when we start introducing music where perhaps Christ is not the dominant, Christianity is not the dominant religion. For example, I in studying Indian classical music, and the two dominant faiths are Islam and Hinduism, I wanted to play a drum solo for the offertory, And I approached my choir director and her husband, and they essentially asked me, not in these exact words, but they essentially said, what does this have to do with Christianity? And so what I felt was that they were so attaching this European tradition onto into Christianity, into Christian faith, that I didn't know exactly what to say to them, but my pastor, being dead set on having those drums in the church service, we had those drums in the church service. Now the question is am I introducing Hinduism into the Christian liturgy? I don't know about that. There are numerous Christians actually who play this kind of music in India, and I think that's one thing that needs to be understood, is that to what extent does something have a religious attachment, and when does it not? Like if someone plays a Bach cello suite, is it by virtue that Bach was Christian that therefore that makes it okay to play it? Does that automatically have a Christian identity, so to speak? And one last comment is that I have a fellow student who is actually the choir director at another Lutheran church in Seattle, and their congregation wanted to have, you know, some kind of multicultural night, or I exactly what it was. And so he plays this long instrument called a koto from Japan, and has a totally different tuning than our tuning on the piano. And so what they wanted was the koto to play with the Green Book hymnal. And so he really didn't want to do this, but he ended up retuning the whole koto and sort of playing chords on the koto. And I don't. He didn't really like that because he felt like he was betraying tradition of Lakota. I don't see a whole lot of harm in that, but that's another example, though, for me, of sort of diluting the tradition of Koto. And why don't we have the Koto with its own tuning and having its own musical structure in service? Is that automatically become Shinto or Buddhist in our Christian liturgy? That's the only one I wanted to say.
Thanks. Bill?
As far as the question about what your drum solo might have to do with Christianity, I might suggest that there's nothing Christian about bread or wine until it's consecrated.
Yeah.
Or the money we put in the plate may say, in God we trust, but it doesn't mean it until we put it in the plate.
So we are talking here with everything about the interface between culture and faith, too, that nothing is inherently sacred to Well, others. Let's open it up here.
Why do people become fussy then about the kind of music you play at weddings?
The words.
Can I play any?
It's the words, though, John.
It's the words.
It's not the music without words.
Well,
maybe not entirely.
Well, whenever we hear that, what do you think?
Becomes
into your mind.
Did you have a point that you wanted to make about that? Do you think we should not be fussy about the music at weddings? Or
no, I think we are rightly fussy. And the real question is, how far can you go? You know, I think there probably is music which is deeply embedded in Shintoism. And I would wonder if they would want, or we would want, to try to put that into another setting.
On the other hand, they wouldn't question a Mozart piece being used as an offertory, which was very secular. And I don't know if it had a religious significance in Hinduism, it might be one thing, but I would assume that maybe some people have been missionaries, that if you had a Christian church in India, that they would use some of the native instruments, that they would blend some of these traditions in their church. I would hope so.
Key's got a hand up here.
Yeah, I lived in India a while, just outside of Bangalore, which is in the southern central part of the state, and it's a small community called the Ecumenical Christian Center, which a lot of Lutherans pass through on occasions, and a lot of St. Louis students go there. They have a very active community, and the experience of taking different cultural elements in religion and music and kind of blending it together, along with ceremony, different ceremonies that we're not used to in our church in terms of performing and using incense and a different sort of dance, actually, in the church service. It's called syncretism. It's quite an interesting thing. If we kind of turn this whole topic on its head for a second and look at what we have done in terms of Christian missionaries going out across the globe and bringing Western music to non-Western cultures, and then ask yourself the question, if these people, in a sense, not necessarily opening their arms and accepting it, but in a sense having it thrust upon them and saying, this is the music that you should be following because it's Christian music. And in a sense, then, it is Western music being infused into Eastern cultures. And it raises a lot of questions. The beauty that I saw in the Ecumenical Christian Center in Whitefield was that the kind of cultural vitality that the people had in their own life, in their own ritual, their own symbolisms that exist, were brought and fused in with Christianity, which created a very beautiful and very exciting service to be part of. And their aspect of faith seemed to be dramatic and alive, and for them, and it really made a lot of sense in terms of music being meaning for them, and meaning having a lot to do with what their faith has to say, or what their faith is about. And it's a very exciting thing to witness, to see that. And I think we turn the question on its head, it really raises some interesting questions as well. But.
Thanks.
I live in Anchorage, Alaska, and we have a newly formed native Lutheran church there, and they've recently purchased Inupiat drums and are incorporating that in their music. And the rhythm is just enervated their music. It's really exciting to listen to them now. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops.
I was in Tanzania for a year, and the first thing that I heard were the drums and the choir singing, and they didn't have an organ or anything like that, but they sang. They have a green book that's like our liturgy, and it's all in Swahili, and then they have a lot of the German hymns, the good hymns, and they've put Swahili words to them, but that's not their music. And there was a professor up in Arusha at the seminary, and he has taken the time to have the people sing their songs, which I don't know what you call it, when they sing and then someone sings and then there's a response.
Antiphonal.
What is that?
An antiphon, like an antiphon.
Yeah, that's their kind of singing. And it's very alive and very rich. And he has recorded theirs, and he has written a book of their own music, which is just beautiful. And we try.
Is that Howard Olson's book?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And to oppose our hymns and say, now these are the things that you should be singing. It's not their music, and their music is so loud.
And how do you like it when their music then is brought here? When we try to sing
their music. It's hard to sing. It's hard for us to sing that because we're not.
Or to listen to it, be like listening to it.
I just love it.
But do they love listening? I mean, you say that it's just not theirs when they have to sing the old German hymns, even if they're translated. So do you feel like they shouldn't be singing the German hymns?
It's okay, but I don't think that that's what they should be having to use all the time. Maybe there's a blending of the two, but I think their own music is really more meaningful to them.
It might be that we're faced with a little bit different problem than I know. The church that I belong to in Chicago has got a sizable American mm-hmm. black population, a sizable African black population, has got a lot of Cambodians, and well, then every other possible mixture of Northwestern Europeans, all in one very small church. And it seems like in our church the response has been to be as orthodox, old-fashioned Lutheran as possible in our music. We even do the Santa Lucia service December 13th, and we go through the whole thing and sing the Santa Lucia song, you know, and have the buns and the candles and everything. And it could be a Cambodian girl or a Ghanaian girl or whatever, but we...
You got a Lucia queen.
Yeah, but it's like they decided, look, we couldn't possibly satisfy all these people, so let's just have one narrow thing, and they can join our culture. I don't know whether that's right or wrong. There are certainly people in our parish who don't like this very much.
But I feel about music the way I do about food. And that is, I like good food, but I'm so glad that I don't have to have meat and potatoes every day. I mean, I love to go to foreign restaurants, and I don't want it all the time, but I love the opportunity to have different kinds of food, and I think music's somewhat the same. I remember when we took our young people to our very rural Lutheran church, very rural, I mean, not a black person within 50 miles, up to a black Baptist church. I have a friend who belongs to a black Baptist church in Minneapolis, and they loved the choir. And then we invited them to come down, so their choir came down to our church, you know, and they sang. And then that inspired some of the teenagers to want to do a choir too, not their choir, but our choir. And they were also asking if we could do more fun songs. I mean, we were looking frantically through the hymn book trying to find some songs that were well, but is that not valid in some extent? I mean, I was hearing Gracie Grendel speak, and she said, well, you know, we used to have camp songs, and we used to sing Sunday nights, but we don't have Sunday night services anymore. So nobody sings the fun songs anymore. There isn't an opportunity anymore. So you never... The old songs that everybody used to be able to sing for fun aren't sung. Mm-hmm. That's the other side of it.
Well, the kids used to go to church camp.
We had a couple of hands over here. You, and then some, didn't one of you back here have a hand up? I'm just trying to referee this. Did you want to?
I'm still a little concerned about that big hang up on classicism of music. The Gregorian chant with notes and so on, and later music is a natural growth and procession up to today. And it would seem with our big interests of today in multiculture and so on, we should be introducing these other forms of music to fit an expression of the people.
Do you want?
Sure, if you want to respond.
I've been thinking a lot of this last couple of weeks up here. There's been so much talk about this. It's on my mind constantly. You know, the thing about those Bach chorales, for instance, Bach chorales are meant to be sung in four parts by people that sing perfectly in tune. That is, perfectly in tune according to the standards of Northwest European music, with A approximately 440 nowadays. And you've got to sing your thirds high and your sevenths high, and that's what a Bach chorale sounds like. And it sounds wrong if you sing it out of tune. Mm-hmm. But these other musics we're talking about don't have anything like those kind of standards of intonation. They may have either other standards of intonation, or they may have much laxer standards of intonation, which that's not wrong at all. But a person is brought up, you don't sing with that kind of intonation automatically. You have to be trained to do it and reinforced in it constantly, trained in the schools, trained through your church choirs, in order to sound good doing that music. I really wonder if you sing, take that kind of approach to singing and then put it in another style, people would say, well, that style's wrong. But the fact is, our popular music now doesn't care anything like that about that kind of intonation. And so then if you're embedded in popular music, and you're sort of approximating this pitch and approximating that pitch, which is part of the style for that, and then you try to sing a Bach chorale.
But then that was to be in a Greek cathedral with the choir here and
yeah.
here and here and here, answering back and forth and so on, in beautiful harmonies and up through the ceiling, just like Sugar's big thing about spaciousness and so on. This is where Bach and his organ that only played loud or super soft, there was no in between, as we hear today. It's a whole world in itself.
I guess I'll just say something very quickly and then we'll do something else. But what Lyle was doing, we're talking about in his session earlier this evening, is that people don't just sit down and strum on those instruments in Afghanistan. They put years and years into learning how to do those modes and to play that kind of music. Just as a good classically trained musician in our tradition spends years learning how to do that. You can't do both things. You really can't be, I mean, if you want to perform at a really high level, you narrow yourself. And we didn't used to have this problem because we didn't know anything about all those other things. We just knew that we had to sing in tune when we sang our hymns on Sunday. And we sang a certain way. But what I fear is that what he was talking about, dilution, or this gray stew, you lose the ability to really perform well, to do well with the music that we've got in our culture when you're very concerned about music of other cultures. I mean, I'm presenting this as a dilemma, not as a solution.
Well, it sounds like we've got here, if I can just cast this a little bit too, the dilemma between performance versus participation, also the question of the role of the music leader and in a worship service, how much of it is the excellence versus full participation of everybody there too. So that also is a dilemma, and that's not just cast as multicultural versus unicultural, it's also how mass do we want to have our participation in, of course.
And what the choir does versus what the choir
okay,
does.
I want to, let's get a couple other hands over here. George or Nancy, who was it?
I'm not actually sure where to go now because I have about 40 thoughts.
Yeah.
But, so maybe I'll just start talking and see what happens, and when it gets long, we can
Well, okay, let's pause then. I had two questions that I was going to ask. How many of you in this room, let's just take a straw vote, it's always fun to see where people are, would say your faith has been enriched by the great traditional music of choral singing or classical sort of hymn singing? Mm-hmm, pretty many here. Okay, how many people in this room would say your faith has been enriched by some kind of multicultural experience that you've had musically, whether it be the Tanzanian drumming or something Native American, or going to a global mission event and hearing that group from El Salvador that's been at those, or something like that? How many have had a significantly faith-enriching multicultural experience as well? Yeah, so in a sense, we all kind of agree with each other. We all want both. And yet it's a question of how to do it with integrity in a way, and maybe that's how we can sort of puzzle over it too. There's a third piece that we haven't really brought in, which is the question of how much and how fair is it to steal or appropriate music from other cultures as well. The United Methodist Church, I don't know if any of you are Methodists here, but had an interesting experience with putting together their new hymn book this past year, where they wanted to be more embracing of a whole number of cultures, and were planning to include in it a service from the Native American tradition, a full service. And then Native American people said, no, this isn't fair. You know, you white people come and take our land. You've taken everything from us, all the wealth of our traditions, and now you want to steal our spirituality as well. This isn't right. And I think there's those questions too about how fair is it to borrow willy-nilly from other people's traditions when they have integrity in those cultures too. So that's another issue. I mean, the South African Freedom Service we sometimes do here is taken from South African music via a Swedish singing group and now popularized at Holden Village with English words. Is that rightly South African? Is that fair? We're not paying money to anybody, you know, or that, those kinds of questions too. But anyway, all right. Who's got thoughts on any of these things? Nancy, okay.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that, and I think there's a way that this third question gets tied in with some of the other ones, because it seems to me part of the question is, for whom are you making music? And this issue of imposing Western music through the mission, the whole mission phenomenon, on other cultures, one thing that happens, I think, and maybe I'm overgeneralizing, our church organist is Filipina and is, I think, second generation Christian. Her parents were missioned to and converted. And we do primarily Western music, but it's schlock. It's the sort of music that Bruce was talking about, that's very shallow and very easy, and but it has no soul. And I can't help thinking that part of the reason it has no soul is that it's not our organist music. It's something that was imposed on her. And I think there is a danger that we do the same thing if we try to borrow shallowly. So it seems to me that part of the solution to the dilemma, if there is one, is rather than saying, well, we've got to have a little bit of Buddhist music and or a little bit of Cambodian Laotian Vietnamese music and a little bit of African music and a little bit of Eskimo music, you know, because we have potentially a church that embraces all those cultures. That we should say, as individual congregations, what music is relevant to us and what music can we get immersed in?
An immersion.
So that we do it well, and so that it has life.
I'd say another crucial factor is who represents this music. In many ways, I feel uncomfortable even talking about other cult. Other traditions when I haven't really grown up and lived in those traditions for a long time. I'm beginning to feel comfortable after 4 years of immersion in another musical tradition intensively every single day, practicing it. But I think, like, you know, is that going back to that example of the tape, you know, you can buy a tape here of the South African freedom songs, but they're sung by
Swedes,
you know. And who's it benefiting?
Yeah, and then another thing I've heard, just to follow up with the Native American peoples also say, is what right do you have to appropriate our spirituality if you don't also join in our justice struggles?
Mm-hmm.
And that's an issue too, that in a sense, you know, up here at Holden, a lot of people get into sort of nature spirituality and want to start using Native American prayers, but what so many Native Americans struggle with now is issues of treaty rights and land, and there are huge justice struggles out there too that they invite us to join in. And should we just take the music and not their causes as well? So all these kinds of questions. Fascinating. Thanks. Was there another hand? Bill? Uh-huh.
I think one thing that does happen, just as the Gregorian chant tradition and the chorale tradition are used by very fine contemporary church composers in music that is obviously contemporary but deeply influenced by these traditions. So to the extent that composers from our tradition can immerse themselves for a significant period of time in another culture, or can people from another culture who come to this country and become part of our church tradition can compose music that I think can be as valid a blend of different traditions with integrity as the music written today out of the Western tradition is a valid blend of many different Western traditions. It's not easy to do, though.
Okay, you
had a joint lens service with a Methodist from Indiana, Southern Indiana, And he set up us after singing together for 4 weeks. We sang something from the Southern Hymnary or there's a
Southern Harmony.
Southern Harmony, yeah. And we sang all 7 verses. He said, well, you're getting close. If we sung 30 verses, you might have got the rhythm right. And the question was, he said, well, it was sort of nice to try it, but you ruined the hymn. We tried our best. You know, and it's in the hymnal now. And frankly, I think anybody, the next pastor that comes along there, is going to be very careful if he hears this story. Stay away from any tune like that, because that's not the cultural tradition in southern Minnesota, and we can't sing that music, not faithfully to the rhythm that's in that thing. And I suspect when we get to some of the black spirituals, we don't really resound the way they should. And that's a question, you know, should we have those things in the hymnal, in our hymnal, not necessarily the hymnal for the whole church, should we use those things if we can't do them well?
The influence of the music is not necessarily that we take directly from the other culture, but we allow certain amount of their blending of, I'm at a loss for words, a blending, you know, our music and their music coming together to form a new music rather than a direct.
Well, yeah, well, we should not have taken the Southern Hymnary for a Minnesota church. We should have simply said that stuff should be absorbed and taught in the colleges, and maybe 40 years from now we'll have a modified version. But the Southern Hymnary people would not like that, because if it's not faithful to what they want, it's not ever going to sound right when we sing it.
Maybe part of the question here too is how we move towards greater inclusiveness even in our congregations. Because we're using kind of we and they, and I mean, they is all of us too, because we're in many cultures, or many congregations are very multicultural already too, but it sounds like yours isn't particularly.
Well, yeah, I know that was a specific example, yeah.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, you were going to talk next, excuse me, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it seems sometimes we indicate that the ethnic or primitive or other musical cultures are sort of in a box that they don't pick up from, we take from them as though they don't take from us, unless we force it onto them. I at one time saw a very interesting situation, this down in the Southwest Pacific, in one part of it, at one time it was the German tradition had gone in. In fact, they had owned a large part of that, New Guinea. The Hollandia and this area there. And of course, as we had observed it, the music that they had was almost, the natives had almost all been related to violence and sex. It was all, to watch it, it was all very descriptive of violence and sex. Now if you took, say, German missionaries took hymns, the thoughts of say Christianity into that context, and tried to use that music, it wouldn't fit too well. So they had taught them some of those hymns. But the interesting thing was that when we heard the natives sing, by the time we got down there, you could hear elements of the German tradition. You could hear some, because they'd been taken over by Australia after that. You could hear some of the English tradition, and you could hear some of this primitive stuff. So they had absorbed and taken it over into their own, and were seemed to be very happy and content with it. Well, content is a poor choice. Where I don't live, content with it, but there was one other point I wanted to make. As far as taking, there was something that some young people, younger than I am, introduced a while back with some music that Paul Simon had taken and worked out with some people down in Africa. And as I listened to it, now of course it was not in a religious context.
Does everybody know that, the Graceland?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Album,
but
yeah.
By the mixture of forms, it was exciting. I mean, it could very easily, that kind of thing would be very fantastic, I think, in it. It would have to take some reworking, no doubt, but these new forms, some of them are thrilling to listen to.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. George?
I guess two comments. One, where I think it's kind of related to what you were saying earlier, and that is that it's not possible to separate music and culture from power relations. And one of the things that really concerns me is when we abstract kind of in music from that, it's very dangerous, I think, because I think it seems to be like one of the ways of looking at being with other people and other cultures, and in some way having an exchange of culture, an exchange of music, is to develop some kind of bridge of mutuality, where it means we need to pay more dues, working for social justice, or some other way, to be kind of come down from our position of power and oppression of those people, like a lot of folks we were talking about throughout the conversation here tonight. We need to pay some other dues, I think, if we're going to be in a place of mutuality, before we can really even begin, I think, to ethically have a further discussion. I think the other piece of it has to do with this issue of performance versus participation. I'm a folkie, I'm a lousy singer, and I love to sing. I also know a lot of the music I hear from the mountains, and that's where my heart is in the mountains of southeastern United States. That's where some part of my roots are. And what I know is that music is extremely vital, but the performance quality is quite variable. I mean, I just soon hear somebody who sings in tune and is talented instrumentally. What I know is next to that, I like to hear someone who's got that level of vitality and maybe is off tune a little bit. And so there's some issues there about kind of playing music from the heart, particularly coming up out of the folk culture, that I think it would be a shame, I think, for us to not still consider that. And believe me, I don't like mediocrity. So I'm not arguing for mediocrity, but this one group we belong to had a slogan that says, we prefer crude vigor to polished banality. So that's kind of maybe a way of thinking about it.
But the other thing that group demonstrated, that was a group that got together to do theater and music and loud political discussion routinely. And the other thing that group demonstrated is that one could have crude vigor with some polish. You know, that really what music or theater or whatever you're doing takes is some attention to it and practice. And if you do that, you get good, you know.
And over here, uh-huh.
I'm pastor of a small church that has a very excellent choir, and we're very poor hymn singers. I'm concerned, I think I can get this phrased here, it's kind of a question in process, but I'm concerned, it's kind of in the area of participation, about the couple of things. Some of it comes out of the interaction of sound and silence in worship. The other part is the sense that a whole lot of people in our churches, because of the emphasis on quality, and I'm not putting down quality either, most people feel like they don't have a sound that's worth hearing. Right? I think that's true in my congregation. I don't know if it is for yours or not. And some kind of reconciliation is needed there, and I think it really is impacting the lack of spiritual formation in the churches. I think the interaction of sound and silence is something very significant to the lack of spiritual vitality in our churches. And I look at, in Seattle anyway, the growing popularity of something like Taizé chants, where people can enter into it in a simple way and make their sound and feel like something is happening in their souls, instead of nurturing congregations who say who all they know how to do is say, "My, wasn't the choir wonderful?" You know, I want the choir to be wonderful, but I want the people saying that to say, "I have a sound that I can make too, and God wants to hear it.
Yeah.
God wants to hear my sound." Somewhere in all of this, the power relationships and the participation, it seems to me that we need to be asking that question of what really is happening for the souls of our people out of our music.
It seems to me that there should be a way for pastors and ministers of music and choir directors and whoever to do that for a whole congregation. I remember when I was a kid going to church in Tennessee in the 50s. And now that I think about it, I think this did happen on Wednesdays and Sunday nights rather than Sunday morning. But I remember the minister, who was not a musician, saying to the congregation how to sing the hymn, mm-hmm. you know, and saying, that sounded really good. Now let's hear all the women. Now let's put the men in, you know, and hear how much richer that sounds. It seems to me there should be a way for the minister and the people who are responsible for the music to kind of nurture the musical sense.
Sure, all you need is a longer week.
Did you? Okay,
not.
Yeah, I agree with him. I think that you do need to separate what you want everyone to sing, because you do want to encourage people to sing. And I don't agree with my husband. I think if I want to sing Go Tell on the Mountain and I don't sing it perfectly, but it means something to me, I should be able to sing it, you know. It's important to me. And I think we're asking churches to do a lot that they didn't used to have to do, to sing well. Because you brought it the other night, that we used to be able to sing a lot of these songs in school. I mean, I was in high school. I have a very mediocre voice, but I was in the high school choir, and we sang Mendelssohn's Elijah. And it meant an enormous amount to me. It was a very moving experience. And I remember much of the music today, but that could never be repeated today in a high school, public high school. And we're saying that the church must encourage people to sing, enjoy singing, sing quality, maybe get some, listen to some multicultural experience. We're asking to do almost the impossible, because this is the only place they can get any kind of sacred music. And we used to hear it all around.
Okay. We're down to our kind of last 10 minutes here, so I just wanted to alert those of you who haven't said anything yet that you might want to think about. If you're waiting to get in a last word towards the end of the evening, it's coming around to be that time. I'm a little concerned that everyone that's spoken so far has been European Americans, and I'm wondering if, Nadine, do you have anything that you'd be willing to add? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but you led us in a Vespers the other night that was really... No, okay, you don't have to.
Call me by name in this. I don't know if I'm going to put you on the spot.
All right, okay, I will rescind that here. But just thinking about the whole question of white people doing spirituals. You taught us several the other night. Or was it last week we did? Last Friday.
What?
That you guys did Vespers.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so not everybody in this room was here then. I'm sorry, okay.
How do you feel about this?
How do I feel?
About white people singing.
Well, I should put you on the spot here.
Thank you, Origin.
All right, well, let's hear from other people that haven't said anything, if there is anybody else, since we are down into our last couple minutes.
I was brought up in the Catholic tradition, so I was kind of removed from the black gospel music. But I do sometimes go to black churches because I need that music. I need to hear that sound. But sometimes there's something inside of me that cries when I hear some of the black spirituals sung by non-black people. There just isn't that transference of that soul in that music. And I think it's the same thing when we take music from other cultures. Somehow that soul is lost. That within that culture, Bach is fine within that culture, but when we bring in other musics, some of the soul is missing, I feel.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I spent the month before I came to Holden this summer with something called the Robert Shaw Choral Institute in France. And we made two CDs. And one of the CDs we made, which will be available for public sale in the next 6 months, was of Robert Shaw and Alice Parker's arrangements of Black Spirituals and Southern Harmony. One side of the CD, or half the CD, will be Black, and the other half will be Southern Harmony. But I've got to say, all of us were trained professional Western singers, and there was not, in fact, a single Black singer in the entire group. And we spent hours learning to say guayna, and to do these things, to do these very carefully notated versions of these songs. And then we performed them several times. We went on tour and we performed them night after night. I have to say, I hated it. I just hated the experience, and we did it opposite Brahms. We do Brahms one night, and then we do these spirituals the next night, and then Brahms the next night, and then spirituals the next night. And I loved the Brahms concerts, and the spiritual concerts drove me crazy, because I was sitting there counting like mad to come in on the offbeat on guayna, you know? It just, it was all...
wrong.
Well, it was for me. And yet, I know that the reason we made this recording is because this is going to be a bestseller. It's going to make a lot of money for the people that recorded it. It's going to make a ton of money for Robert Shaw. And that is because people really love this. They really love this music. And they like the Robert Shaw recordings and performances of it. And I never was able to come to any conclusion about this in my whole experience over there, except that every night I hated it more than I did the night before.
Well, I think it gets somewhat to what George was bringing up too about the power relationships and that lack of mutuality there as far as just taking somebody's music and making money off it. Obviously, Sven, did you have a hand?
Yeah, I'm a member of the Lutheran Church, the ELCA, and I'm very happy to have heard several times the statement, "We are committed to inclusiveness." So I think that it's perfectly all right to have all kinds of stuff in our hymnal, because otherwise how are we going to draw in people of different cultures if they can't even find one or two things from their own culture? We might learn to sing along with them.
Mm-hmm. The thought has entered my mind, what if we turn this the other way, upside down? And how do other cultures, how do we feel if other cultures sing our music? And I think that we'd feel flattered, we'd feel good that we could share. That's just an individual feeling, that if they wanted to, that I think that we feel good about it. And I also feel that every time I've sung in a group and we have some songs of other cultures, I know that we can't sing them like they do. But it's been a delightful experience to try something different and to get acquainted with it. And to me, it's always been a delight, even though I know that we can't begin to sing it like it's supposed to be sung, and we can't sing it like they do. It's still fun.
Mm-hmm.
The question that was asked of you when you wanted to do the drum offertory bothers me, because I saw that as your offering to the Lord.
Right.
Your worship, your way of being able to give your gift and your offering and your praise to the drum. I don't know why that couldn't be acceptable.
That's the first thing I thought of too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what does the choir director do with the monotone in the choir that wasn't trying to choir? Mm-hmm.
Put it in the back row.
Put it in the back row. Put it in the choir at all?
Mm-hmm.
That's a very interesting question.
Well, I just wanted to say, for example, I'm Norwegian Lutheran background, and I can remember when I was little, preschool, that in the evenings my mother would play the reed organ and she'd sing the Norwegian songs, folk songs, and in Norwegian, and very maybe most of them are minor and rather sad, very sad, I'd say. And I'd sit there, and I was only less than 6 years old, and the tears would come down my cheeks because they were so sad. And she'd sing them in Norwegian, and she'd always say that when you translate them, they lose a lot of their strength and a lot of their meaning. But I still enjoy very much singing the Norwegian songs translated into our language. And I'd miss them, and I feel bad if I somehow can't feel that I ought not to be singing them. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Yeah. Jim had a hand there. Okay, Margaret, and then Jim. Jim, you can have the last word, or Margaret, you can have the last word here. We're kind of winding up. Who would like
Margaret to? Can have the last word.
Okay, Jim, you can have the penultimate, and Margaret, you can be the ultimate voice here.
I wanted to go back and really, I guess, affirm what George said about the difficulty of dealing with these issues abstractly. And it seems to me that our conversation really has touched on several concretions that have different faces. And in terms of some particular histories that have to do with the United States and the people that live there, there are certain kinds of music that really the resolution to the perplexities that we have are not musical resolutions and don't have to do with whether or not congregations can learn this or learn that. But the resolutions have to do with what's happening in society. And I really think that we can't deal abstractly with these questions. It's simply because in the case, for example, of Native Americans or African Americans, we have not paid the price of those songs. And those songs come from people's experience. And so something's got to be happening sociologically. It gives us the opportunity to, as it was put, to pay some dues that maybe resolve some of the perplexities that really we cannot resolve in the confines of the walls of the congregation wrestling with questions of harmony and music.
Can I
say
something?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I do have something to say. In listening to the conversation back and forth, I think our underlying struggle here is trying to have a context to fit things in, and they don't fit anymore.
No.
They just don't. We have to begin to open up and see that they don't fit, and then deal with the fact that we're outside of our realm. We're outside of the context now. We're outside of the four by four music and the John Phillips, Susan March type of thing. And it's time for us to learn a new way, a new experience, and then have a different group teaching us.
Thanks. Margaret, the voice from the balcony.
Mine was just more or less a question about the, you said that if Bach isn't sung just right, it loses everything. But then every music that comes from a culture, if it's not sung just right, it loses. And even though we sang Bach and maybe we lose something, okay, then we sing other cultures' music and we might lose something. But like this lady said, we're trying. And I guess that's what's important, is that we're trying. Good ending, but.
Well, thanks. Well, we probably should end with a song, but I was just trying to think now what would be the perfect song.
Culture song.
Yeah, it's somewhere in the middle.